Colombia, organizing against a Montreal-based multinational corporation. They are fighting an Alcan-backed bauxite mine that would displace them from their homes, destroy their culture, their spiritual sites, livelihood, clean water, and clean food. We, the people of Montreal, need to take their message directly to Alcan. Alcant in India is organizing a demonstration at the Alcan General Meeting, Thursday, April 22nd at 9:30 a.m. Meet at 2200 Mansfield Street, ready to make noise. To learn more about the issue, come to a teach-in at the South Asian Women's Community Center on Saturday, April 17th from 2 to 4 p.m. at 1035 Rachel Street East.
We can win this.
This is a CKET Code Disruption, supported by Cooper McGill and Cooper Concordia.
You are listening to Off the Hour. This is CKET 90.3 FM. We're joined on the line by Rocco Galati, constitutional lawyer who withdrew his representation of clients labeled so-called security threats late last year. He joins us on the phone from Toronto. We're also joined by Yervar Hamid, who's from Ottawa, where he works as a human rights lawyer, and he is also a member of the Justice Committee from Mohamed Harkat. Welcome both to the program. Thank you guys for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Yervar, let's start with you. You've been following what's happened in Ottawa last week. Can you offer us your reflection on the media's coverage and the role of the Department of Foreign Affairs in charging a so-called terrorist in our midst under Bill C-36?
I think that there are certain contradictions that we see in the way that the charging has taken place and the sort of the level of publicity that's been given to this whole affair. On the one hand, what I may get to later is sort of the veil of secrecy that covers the process and the machinations leading up to an actual arrest. But in this case, we have a real overt publicization of the event. We have things that are said, not necessarily publicly by the RCMP, but by media here locally and internationally in Britain, potentially linking this suspect, Momina Khawaja, to a broader terrorist ring. And yet the RCMP is very closed-mouthed about the whole thing. And so on the one hand, there's this net which is sort of broadly cast in terms of publicly lumping this guy Khawaja in with this broader security threat, and on the other hand, we don't know the specific allegations. One of the things that I find quite interesting, and at least the way that the event was portrayed by the Globe and Mail, is that in the actual arrest of Mr. Khawaja, we have some indication that this wasn't just a spur of the moment incursion or intrusion into his home, but actually he was been followed for some time. And yet the method of arrest involved a series of, I think, over 20 arresting and SWAT officers, a battering ram to break down his door. And so there's this massive intrusion into the home of the suspect. And on the other hand, the question is raised as to the impact of others in his immediate family. The answer that's given, or at least reported, is that the whole family was subsequently taken for questioning so as not to disrupt the integrity of the scene. And so in some sense, there's at least some ostensible message of the RCMP trying to be humane in its tactics, but on the other hand, they're really using a sledgehammer for something for which, if they were following quite closely, they could have dealt with in a much less intrusive way.
Yervar, I hear you talking about the hows behind Khawaja's indictment, he being the first person. The mainstream media kept sort of sensationalizing that he was the first person indicted under C-36. You're talking about how that process came to be. But Rocco, perhaps we can bring you into this conversation. You can talk about perhaps why this indictment is happening under C-36 now. This is legislation that you came to Montreal about this time last year, speaking about something that was passed pretty quickly here in Canada, yet now we're at this point where the first indictment's coming through. Why do you think this is happening now?
Well, it's all perpetual. I agree with everything that's been said. Everything, all the allegations and all the arrests and the search warrants are always done with the biggest circus hoopla you could muster. And, you know, the Project Threat arrests here in Toronto, 19, you know, it's no coincidence it was 19 plus 2 later, exactly the same number as the 19 alleged terrorists down in New York and then 2 later arrested. You know what I mean? Like, they have to think we're complete idiots, right, in terms of the symbolism. Not one of them was ever charged with anything, and the RCMP and CSIS backpedaled, saying, you know, yeah, they have nothing to do with terrorism. It was all a mistake. They were just immigration infractions. We know we have spent over $7 billion, according to the Auditor General, since 9/11 on security in this country. You would expect at least one charge after 2.5 years for $7 billion. Okay, there have been hundreds of charges under the Migratory Bird Act, infractions under that act since. But what's startling is that if you believe all the hype and the rhetoric that there are hundreds of Al-Qaeda members in North America in sleeper cells, fact of the matter is when the evidence actually comes out in court, out of U.S. documents, there was only ever 200 hardcore Al-Qaeda members alleged to exist. I don't know if you know that. In the whole world, you know, but they all happen to be here and everywhere at the same time. But when you take all of that into account and you say, well, you know, did we really need this legislation? As they said we did, we told them they didn't need it in 2001. How do you justify $7 billion, the entire turning of inside out your society, topsy-turvy, your everything's gone upside down, and we have one single charge? Now, we don't know anything about the charge yet. Can't be too serious because it's not, they haven't, from what I understand, and perhaps I can be corrected, they haven't actually coupled any murder or attempt murder or any such charges. It's simple association from what I see. So after 2.5 years, all we have is one charge. In Germany, there's only been 2 people ever taken to court. That's the only place in the Western world where people have actually been charged under the new post 9/11, and both were acquitted. The first one was acquitted outright. The second one was convicted, but then the appeal court just threw out his conviction several weeks ago. So what we really want to ask ourselves, if you're asking the question, why now? I say, well, it's about long bloody overdue if we're to take these guys seriously. I don't take them seriously. As I've been saying for the last 5 years, not since 9/11, but before 9/11, all this hoopla, all this nonsense, all this mess is simply a cover to hammer the anti-globalists, to hammer the anti-poverty movement in North America. This is a smokescreen for depriving of our democratic rights, our civil liberties, for a much larger economic agenda. I cannot believe that anybody would take anybody seriously if they said, after 2.5 years and $7 billion, given the pervasive terrorism problem there was in Canada, we've charged one kid in Ottawa.
Well, Khawaja's family is probably taking the situation pretty seriously. So is the family of the 5 men who were detained on security certificates. But
I'm not saying that. Quite right. And my clients were held on security certificates. I'm talking about the average thinking citizen who is listening to our government. If you're not in a coma, then you can't take the government seriously or at its word when they put this stuff forward. They have to be questioned and called on it.
Well, let's talk about questioning and calling on it. We have an opportunity to put CSIS on trial here. We have on the line with us a human rights lawyer from Ottawa. We also have on the line with us a constitutional lawyer from Toronto. And Rocco, you had an opportunity to actually cross-examine CSIS in one of your cases. If CSIS had to defend its own record against C-36, what would that prosecution look like?
Well, I've cross-examined CSIS officers several times in several cases, and some of the startling stuff that's come out of those cross-examinations is beyond belief. Number one, they don't consider that they're subject to the Charter. That's what they testify to under oath. The Charter does not apply to them. Constitutional norms do not apply to them. Number two, I had the Ontario Regional Manager, testify that CSIS would rather see an innocent Canadian die before they reveal the source. That might explain why nothing was forthcoming from CSIS, according to RCMP information in the Air India bombing. Third, they have no problem asking dictatorships to detain and torture our citizens to extract information. That is almost now a given. When Mr. Uzgar made those allegations in 2001, the Crown attorneys were laughing conspiracy theory. We now since Arar, Al-Mahdi, Al-Maki, Dr. Hindi, and four others who've come back and told the same stories. And now I understand from a media report, same thing has happened with the father of this kid who's been charged in Ottawa, that the Saudis were holding him and were going to release him. But apparently, CSIS and the RCMP indicated that he should be held. So you have people who consider themselves above the law and the Constitution. They're asking foreign henchmen to detain and torture our citizens. What you have is criminals on the loose with immunity in this country. They're engaged in criminal activity. These are crimes against humanity that they're committing. You don't ask the Egyptians or the Syrians or the Lebanese or anybody else to detain and torture a citizen to see what information you can get. And so if the trials were to take place, and if we were to use the same procedure that they use on everybody else, it would be the families of these people who've been tortured or the persons themselves speaking to a judge in the absence of the officers. They'd all be convicted. These CSIS officers would all be in jail for crimes against humanity if they actually got charged. The fact of the matter is that you can't charge one without the consent of the Attorney General, and no Attorney General in this country is going to charge the CSIS for asking foreign governments to detain and torture our citizens.
Well, maybe not under C-36, but perhaps under a security certificate. We also have Yavar on the line with us, who is working in Ottawa with Mohamed Harket. Maybe you can talk about your situation in trying to give support to Mohamed Harket, who's been one of five Canadians currently detained on a security certificate. What is it like trying to defend yourself against a security certificate?
Well, definitely. I think this resonates with a lot of things that Rocco mentioned. And this goes back to my original comment of sort of the veil of secrecy under which the security apparatus works. The fact that, as Rocco mentioned, that there's been this allocation of $7 billion since 9/11 for the role of an agency, which really since that time was a non-role. In any meaningful sense, has given it a kind of power and ability to flex its muscles in ways that are very repugnant to basic civil liberties. And in the case of people detained on security certificates, one of the real critical issues here is that we just don't know the substantive allegations, the particulars of why these individuals are detained. And this really goes against the fundamental tenets of the right to know the case to meet. And so this obscuring of the particulars, the information under which these people are detained also, I think, is part of the process of procuring this information and keeping it under a veil of secrecy. And what I'd like to comment on there is that in the case specifically of Mohamed Harket, we don't know the particulars. We don't know how the information was garnered, but certainly what we can speculate in light of what we've seen with Maher Arar, what I have seen specifically in clients who I have represented here in Ottawa, the tactics of CSIS to procure information involve things that in a normal course, in terms of sort of any above board judicial or fair interrogation proceeding would be shocking. The fact that CSIS agents will routinely say to people that are being interviewed as witnesses when they make a suggestion that they might like to speak with counsel, it's turned on them. Well, why do you need to speak to counsel if you have nothing to hide? You know, there's no reason that you need to speak to a lawyer. not only do I know this indirectly from clients, but I've been told this by CSIS agents that, why are you representing so-and-so? What does this person have to hide?
And it goes much further than that, too, where it really gets nasty, and it makes you really desperate in analysis, is that, for instance, in the Harkat case, myself and Bruce Engel, the two lawyers, and the witness that we proposed to call, an ex-CSIS officer on behalf of Mr. Harkat, we were all threatened with criminal prosecution if we called them because of the breach of the Secrecy Information Act. And so when you we try to get close to the truth, they threaten your witnesses with criminal prosecution. Now, myself and the other lawyer, although we were concerned, didn't back down from it, but the witness did. The witness was afraid to testify without court protection. The court refused to give the witness protection from criminal prosecution, which is absurd. Second of all, with the Catter case, the kid who came back from Guantanamo Bay, I mean, when you're getting too close to the truth, and sometimes you don't even know what truth you're getting close to, you know, my life was seriously and viably threatened by the CIA with the acquiescence of our government and CSIS. No one, no government body in this country, RCMP, the Toronto Police, the Attorney General's Office, the OPP, no government body in this country, including the political opposition parties in the House, even that they all knew it was a viable threat from the U.S. government to kill me, came to my assistance. No Law Society, no Amnesty International in Ottawa, in Canada, no one. And so what happens is that they get to the point that where the democratic and court process actually is effective in vindicating to a limited measure the rights of these people, then the brutal military machinery comes down on the lawyers with impunity.
Let's talk about the basic human rights at play here. On Human Rights Day, Mohamed Harkat himself was detained on a security certificate. And Yavar, you've been doing support work for him, but given an opportunity to prosecute CSIS on a security certificate, what would the indictment look like if you had that opportunity to I guess, put them in the same situation that they've put Mohamed Harkat in, if CSIS had been detained and indicted on a security certificate on Human Rights Day, what would the media's coverage have looked like, do you think?
That's a very interesting way that you've framed the question. And along that same line, there was on April 1st, just recently, a gathering at Parliament Hill where the families of the five men detained on security certificates spoke out, and they also all signed a symbolic security certificate against the public safety minister, Anne McClellan. And really, what that does and the impact of the symbolic nature of that indictment was that it deprives the person to know any of the accusations against them. And I think that what Rocco mentioned in terms of the real stonewalling that he met in his attempt to defend people who were labeled as security threats, national security threats in Canada, is symptomatic of how this security certificate is so disempowering and so obfuscating. That it's clear what the authorities are doing in leveling these very muddy charges. And if this was to be reflected back on CSIS, for example, I can cite various instances where my clients, newcomers to Canada, some convention refugees, were brought to a Tim Hortons and first of all, dissuaded from getting legal counsel. They were told to think twice about their own security or status in Canada. And now, if I leveled these kinds of criticisms against CSIS without giving names or dates or particulars of my allegations, that would be a hell of a difficult case for them to meet. And so it's clear that we that are questioning the methodology and the tactics of CSIS have to be above board and have to think strategically with people who are able and willing to put their neck on the line to say that we're not intimidated by CSIS, we're not intimidated by the institutional security apparatus here to go up against CSIS and testify. And so that's sort of the imbalance of power that we would be asked to, or we are asked in the present paradigm to put forward all the particular allegations against the institution, but there's this tremendous stigma of the people that are targeted here. I know from experience in the Ottawa Muslim community that in some instances when they are told or that it's suggested to them that they should become informants within the Muslim or Arab community, that it's there's almost an insidious or veiled threat there that, you know, perhaps you should do this or else.
Yeah, I think history and not perhaps too far in the future will show these measures and the people involved in these measures for what they are. They're criminals. They're criminals against humanity. We know the White House lied about 9/11. We know the White House has lied about weapons of mass destruction. We know CSIS has lied. I know CSIS has perjured itself in cases I've done. And we know that while there is some measure of a security threat all over the world for different reasons and different conflicts, and one of the biggest security threats to the world, Europeans will tell you, is the United States of America itself. But while there may be criminals in any society, the biggest criminals are those who control the state apparatus and who use a subtle reign of terror against civil liberties, just the same reign of terror we saw in pre-revolutionary France and revolutionary France and during the American independence. And these measures are dictatorial, they're fascist, and they do it with impunity and they do it without any accountability. And the only way they get to do that is by keeping it in secret and basing it all on a tribal, racist basis that some brown-skinned masses are threatening our way of life. Because if they try to do it on any rational basis, it would never work. If they told Canadians, we have a trade imbalance with Iraq and we need the oil in Iraq, let's go bomb Iraq, Canadians would say, are you out of your mind? But if we keep pushing that tribal, insidious, racist card that the foreigners are threatening our way of life and they're going to crash through your living room and blow up your living room any minute, sure they get away with this stuff.
Is just for a second there, we're going to take a quick musical break and ask the question, is CSIS getting away with it? You are listening to Off the Hour on CKT 90.3 FM. Coming back in just a moment with a look at accountability and CSIS. Who is defining national security in Canada? Is it the public or is it CSIS? Do stay tuned. This is Off the Hour on CKT 90.3 FM. Back in a moment.
Not much, don't touch. It's a world full of cops. Cops backstage and cops in the wings. Cops cared for the benefit of kings. Big brother cops and little sister cops and lots. It's a world full of cops. Cops on the take, taking half of what you got. Driving in the parks and walking in the parking lots. Cops that are cool and cops that are hot and lots. It's a world full of cops. Border cops and shore patrol cops on the guard. Military cops and prison cops above the yard. The finest and the fullest and the hardest of the heart and the rest. It's a world full of cops.
You are listening to Off the Hour. This is CKT 90.3 FM. We're joined on the line by Rocco Galati, a constitutional lawyer who late last year withdrew his representation of clients labeled so-called security threats because of death threats he received from the CIA. He joins us on the phone from Toronto. Yavar Hamid also joins us on the line from Ottawa, where he works as a human rights lawyer and is also a member of the Justice Committee for Mohamed Harkat. And Yavar, but just before the break there, I interrupted you as we were getting into a discussion about CSIS and accountability. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, actually, I had sort of a more general comment to make on the nature of secret information. And this is something definitely, in terms of my involvement with the Committee for Justice for Mohamed Harkat and my involvement, which will soon to be on the legal team for Mohamed Harkat, that we're up against this sort of this institutional veil of secrecy, which, as Rocco was stating earlier, it's racist in its orientation, but it's also, interestingly enough, it's counterproductive, just pragmatically looking at the effectiveness of what secret information is. And by that, I mean that the whole idea of keeping information secret and exchanging information at elite levels is something that has really grown out of a Cold War spy versus spy mentality. And if you pick up the recent edition of this magazine, this very interesting article by an ex-CIA agent by the name of Robert Steele, who talks about the security apparatus's overemphasis upon secret information, the use of secret information and the clothing of information under this secret veil actually narrows the scope of the kinds of information, the kinds of awareness that the security apparatus has. And I think what's interesting when I've spoken to Rocco before on this point is how little that CSIS specialists know about the geopolitics of the world, about specific regions they look at.
But I agree with you, but it's only counterproductive if you actually have bought the used car that the reason these agencies exist is to actually protect us. We have to step away from that naive, stupid thought, okay? I'm not calling you stupid. I'm just saying that we've all bought it to a certain degree. When a CSIS officer says, we would rather let innocent Canadians be blown up in Air India rather than reveal our source, that has to tell you something. They're not there to protect us against a security threat. I don't believe it. Their reason for being is to have a control over our society and our own government and our civil liberties for other agenda. In my cross-examination of CSIS, CSIS admits under oath in federal court that it's never been proven that secret information is the most efficient way to protect us from security threats. Well, that begs the question, what is secret information best for? To avoid accountability.
Well, and
that's the reason it's there. So to the extent that it avoids accountability, it's sure proof, it's fireproof, and that's all it's there for. These security services are not there to protect us, and they say so when they're cross-examined on it. So, but we've. And even myself in the past, I've fallen into the trap of thinking or trying to fight secret information on the basis that it's not the most efficient way to actually get the best information and protect society from terrorist threats. Well, the idiot that I was, I learned the hard way through these cases that that's not why the secret information is there.
But yet in the mainstream media, Rocco, their CSIS and secret information is afforded so much authority. In a sense, it's defining national security here in Canada. And that's largely the question as we wrap up here. Who is defining national security in Canada? Rocco, perhaps you can answer that first, and then we'll go to Yervar.
The persons on the ground who are defining national security are the actual civil servants who run CSIS and run the intelligence services. The people driving the agenda are those same people who are driving the globalization agenda. I mean, anybody, if we're too naive to see the link between so-called security threat and the war on terrorism and the failed globalization trade talks that have happened here since the Mai and Quebec City and Seattle and Washington and Miami, then we're not taking a proper view to this. You can't divorce the so-called war on terror from the global perspective of what's happening economically around the world and who's driving that agenda.
And Yavar?
Yeah, I don't disagree with what Rocco indicated earlier about sort of the agenda of secret information. I think that there is a kind of this notion of fear mongering, which is I think more tacit than overtly propagated here in Canada, but we tacitly accept what's coming out of the United States. And sort of case in point, a new book by a National Post correspondent, Stuart Bell, called Cold Terror, How Canada Nurtures and Exports Terrorism Around the World. I think these kind of sensational headlines are in a way made to convince the public that secure information is the way we can get people like, or secure and secret information is the way that we can arrest people like Momin Khawaja, like others who are already in the public view seen to be terrorist threats and have linked to terrorism, without doing which, from a civil liberties perspective, I think is so important, giving an opportunity for the individual or their counsel to test the evidence that's before them. And just following up on another point that Rocco made, which I think is very important, is the racist tendency of the program, in the sense that we see now more than ever that there is this accent on the fact that the war on terror is a new phenomenon or a new quantity. Mm-hmm. Political terror had been around for decades and centuries. And
well, the French invented it. The Americans perfected it.
And this is certainly a perpetuation of agenda which has existed before, and now it is being painted as a clash of civilizations.
Right.
And part of this, this justification of the secrecy of it is so that this veil cannot be penetrated by a healthy cynicism and skepticism about the motivation of the agenda. We've definitely seen it in terms of how bare the agenda for the justification of the war on Iraq has been, and how this knee-jerk reaction for the United States has been in many ways tacitly accepted by the global community. I think now the anti-globalization resistance in many ways is becoming a viable and an informed threat because it's calling this agenda for what it is.
Yeah, I like to joke sometimes that you can define U.S. or where, particularly U.S. foreign policy by the old joke of the two people meeting on Sherbrooke, one saying to the other, "I'm really sorry to hear about the fire last Thursday," and the other says, "Shh, it's next Thursday."
Rocco and Yavar, I want to thank you both very much for joining us on the program. But as our listeners tune away from the program, we're concluding here. But we encourage people to, as they look to the mainstream media and they see future reports on security, to take something away from this conversation. And perhaps Rocco, as a constitutional lawyer, perhaps you can give us some tips. And Yavar, as a human rights lawyer working in Ottawa with Mohamed Harkat, perhaps you can give our listeners some tips of the next time security and CSIS splashes across their screen. What kind of questions, what kind of eyes should people be taking that media with? Rocco, perhaps if you want to go first.
Well, I mean, not to be melodramatic, but I ask myself, well, if Robespierre or King George or Mussolini or Hitler or Salazar or Franco were telling me this, what would I respond?
And Yavar?
I think we need to look at the source of information and, very importantly, whether information has been tested, and to think about the methodology by which the information was extracted. Is this information come to us by just conjecture, by torture, or by some other means?
I want to thank you again both very much for joining us on this edition of Off the Hour.
Thank you.
Thanks.